The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include Frugal Millennials Could Make Fed's Job Harder, and An Ugly Snapshot of Unhealthy North Carolina, and The Economic Impact of the Outbreak. And we'll begin with Frugal Millennials Could Make Fed's Job Harder. They say millennials are lazy. Billboards plastered across 15 major cities declared last summer, "Retire early and prove them right." That sentiment, reflected in ads for the investment manager Prudential, is the stuff of a 30-year-old's fantasy and the Federal Reserve's nightmare. A young generation of aggressive savers could leave central bankers with less room to cut interest rates, which they have long done to boost growth in times of economic trouble. To leave the workforce early, millennials would need to build up massive retirement funds and consume less in the process. That hit to demand could slow growth and force rates to drop ever lower to entice spending. And if today's workers actually managed to retire young, it would exacerbate the situation by shrinking the labor force, further weighing on the economy's potential. Millennials who are roughly between the ages of 24 and 39 and have not lived through pronounced price spikes already have the lowest inflation expectations of any adult generation. Their belief that cost will not increase could eventually slow actual price gains by making it hard for businesses to charge more. The Fed's main interest rate includes inflation, so that would leave it with even less room to cut. It may not come to this. Millennials could become more worried about inflation as they age, giving companies more room to lift prices. Their difficult post-recession entry into the labor market means many are laden with student debt, so it's unclear if they will be able to retire young. But many indicate that they want to leave the workforce early, an ambition that economists say could spell macroeconomic trouble if realized. It would lower interest rates. That's certainly true, said Joseph Gagnon, an economist at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. It would be a double whammy. It directly raises savings, and it would further reduce the need to invest in factories and offices for these people. Interest rates have been falling for decades, and demographics are a major factor in that decline, economists say. Once people are past middle age, they are living longer without working, corresponding later in life, so they have been saving heavily to fund extended retirements. Millennials, already accused of killing everything from paper napkins to mayonnaise, would happily exacerbate the drop in interest rates, which baby boomers have driven to date. Of millennial workers with an active 401k, 43% expect to retire before the age of 65, based on data from T. Rowe Price. For Generation X, often defined as those aged 40 to 55, that figure is 35%. While the T. Rowe Price survey targeted a privileged group, broader polls have turned up similar findings. Members of Generation X are short on savings, so they may need to work further into old age. But younger people have time to turn things around. While they got a slow start, they are still under the age of 40. Millennials have begun saving more as they work in greater numbers and benefit from a record-long economic expansion. There's even a movement, financial independence, retire early or fire, dedicated to frugality in pursuit of quitting the workforce as soon as possible. Scott Rickens, 36, and his wife Taylor, 35, began following a FIRE plan in 2017. The couple, who have one child, ditched their leased cars and $3,000 a month apartment in San Diego to move to Bend, Oregon. They save more than 50% of their income and aim to have the $1.7 million they think they'll need to retire by their early 40s, though Scott Rickens doesn't plan to completely stop working then. He recently produced a documentary on the FIRE movement, released last year, which drew more than 10,000 people to screenings in over 200 cities. The audience skewed younger, Scott Rickens said, explaining that FIRE appeals to millennials partly because they have faced precarious jobs without pensions. You start to get the sense of lack of control and fear, he said. You can take control of your life. The Rickenses may be extreme savers, but many millennials with means are prioritizing saving. According to a recent Bank of America survey, 25% of millennial savers had amassed more than $100,000, up from 16% in 2018. They have good reason. Millennials have grown up with a dire warning that Social Security will be exhausted by the time it is their turn to use it. They came of age in the worst downturn since the Great Depression, so they are no longer strangers to economic insecurity. But there's a paradox to thrift. Saving, even if virtuous on an individual level, can cause economic trouble en masse. If ambitious cash stockpiling were to catch on, it could exacerbate secular stagnation, a term that Harvard University economist Lawrence H. Summers repopularized to describe the low growth, low inflation state of many advanced economies. When consumers save a big portion of their income, they are not spending as much on dinners out, movie nights, and cars. Businesses respond by investing less in equipment and technology, and productivity stalls. Bosses are unwilling to pay their workers more for the same output, and weak pay gains further restrain spending. Retirement saving behavior is not the only driver causing economic torpor and lower rates. Inequality has left a small number of people with more money than they realistically spend. Lower labor force growth and more iterative technology improvements could also have an impact. The lower interest rates that result from high and unequal saving might sound great, think cheaper mortgages, but they leave economies vulnerable to shocks. In the United States, for example, rates are now in a range of just 1.5% to 1.75%, leaving the Fed room for about 6 quarter-point rate cuts in a downturn. Headed into the last recession, rates topped 5%. Fed officials think mass bond buying and promises to keep rates low for longer can give them power to fight a slump, but the jury is out on whether such alternatives will add enough ammunition to make up for lost room on interest rates. Even Ben Bernanke, a former Fed chair with an optimistic take on the central bank's ability to prop up the economy in a downturn, says officials could end up in a tight spot if rates drop substantially lower. It is anyone's guess whether they will stabilize at low levels, rise, or resume their descent. A continued downtrend is as likely as reversion to normal, Summers said. Lots of the structural forces that are driving this seem likely to continue. That's what makes millennial retirement behavior so interesting. It is a wild card still, one that could slightly lift or substantially lower rates going forward. Policy could influence how things play out. The government could nudge workers toward later retirement or ramp up deficit spending on old age benefits. Summers' research shows that fiscal spending is already propping rates up. Alternately, the uncertainty about fiscal future, whether the present complacency over large deficits continues, could spur millennials to save more now. What is clear is that rates are unlikely to head higher soon. That makes maintaining slow but stable inflation more important than ever. Doing so is proving difficult. The Fed's preferred inflation index accelerated just 1.6% over the past year. It has never sustainably topped 2% since the Fed formally adopted that goal in 2012. That shortfall is threatening to derail inflation expectations. And next, White House unveils $2.5 billion emergency coronavirus plan. The White House on Monday sent lawmakers an urgent $2.5 billion plan to address the deadly coronavirus outbreak, whose rapid spread and threat to the global economy rocked financial markets. The White House Budget Office said the funds are for vaccines, treatment, and protective equipment. The request was immediately slammed by Democrats as insufficient and came as coronavirus fears were credited with Monday's 1,000-plus point drop in the Dow Jones Industrial Average and are increasingly seen as a potential political threat to President Donald Trump. The request was released Monday evening and came as key government accounts were running low. The Department of Health and Human Services had already tapped into an Emergency Infectious Disease Rapid Response Fund and was seeking to transfer more than $130 million from other HHS accounts to combat the virus, but is pressing for more. Today, the administration is transmitting to Congress a $2.5 billion supplemental funding plan to accelerate vaccine development, support preparedness, and response activities, and to procure much-needed equipment and supplies, said White House Budget Office spokeswoman Rachel Simel. We're also freeing up existing resources and allowing for greater flexibilities for response activities. The administration is requesting $1.25 billion in new funding and wants to transfer $535 million more in funding from an Ebola preparedness account that's been a top priority of Democrats. It anticipates shifting money from other HHS accounts and other agencies to complete the $2.5 billion response plan. Senators returning to Washington after a week-long recess will receive a classified briefing Tuesday morning on the government's coronavirus response, a Senate aide said. A spokeswoman for Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Richard Shelby Republican Alabama said the panel will take their input into account as we continue to do our due diligence to determine what additional resources are necessary. Democrats said the request is insufficient and said Trump's attempt to go after existing Ebola prevention funding is dead on arrival. All of the warning lights are flashing bright red. We are staring down a potential pandemic, and the administration has no plan, said Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, New York, who blasted a shortage of kits to test for the virus and President Donald Trump's proposed budget cuts to health agencies like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We have a crisis of coronavirus, and President Trump has no plan, no urgency, no understanding of the facts, or how to coordinate a response. Trump was a vocal critic of President Barack Obama's response to the 2014 Ebola scare, which barely touched the U.S. but was seen as a factor in that year's midterm elections, which restored control of the Senate to Republicans. Trump took to Twitter on Monday to defend his record. The coronavirus is very much under control in the United States. We are in contact with everyone in all relevant countries. CDC and World Health have been working hard and very smart. Stock market starting to look very good to me, he tweeted. Among the needs is funding to reimburse the Pentagon, which is housing evacuees from China who are required to undergo 14-day quarantines at several military bases in California. Democrats controlling the House wrote HHS Secretary Alex Azar earlier this month to request funds to help speed development of a coronavirus vaccine, expand laboratory capacity, and to beef up screening efforts at U.S. entry points. The House Appropriations Committee Chairwoman Nita Lowey, Democrat New York, called the plan woefully insufficient. Despite current warnings from Congress and the public health community, the Trump administration took weeks to request these emergency funds, Lowry said in a statement. Their answer now is to raid money Congress has designated for other critical public health priorities. Azar is slated to testify before the Senate Appropriations Committee on Tuesday, and the U.S. response to the outbreak is sure to be a major topic. The quickly spreading virus has slammed the economy of China, where the virus originated, and caseloads are rapidly increasing in countries such as South Korea, Iran, and Italy. Almost 80,000 people have contracted the disease with more than 2,500 deaths, mostly in China. The United States, however, has had only 14 cases of the disease spread across seven states. In San Francisco, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi took a walking tour of Chinatown on Monday to let the public know the neighborhood is safe and open for business. Pelosi, a Democrat who represents the heavily Chinese-American city, visited the Golden Gate Fortune Cookie Factory, whose owner, Kevin Chan, says his business and others are down 70% since the outbreak of the coronavirus. Come to Chinatown, Pelosi said. Precautions have been taken by our city. We know that there's concern about tourism traveling all throughout the world, but we think it's very safe to be in Chinatown and hope that others will come. Asked about the Trump administration's looming request, Pelosi said she would want to know how the money would be used. Next, an ugly snapshot of unhealthy North Carolina. The Kaiser Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization based in San Francisco, just issued a state-by-state report called Snapshots of Healthcare in North Carolina, in the United States. North Carolina wasn't quite ready for its close-up. In a range of categories, North Carolina, the nation's 10th largest state, with a population just over 10 million, is faring worse than the national average. That picture contrasts sharply with the image of North Carolina portrayed by Republican leaders in the General Assembly. They claim that their tax cuts favoring the wealthy and big corporations and nearly a decade of tight limits on state spending have created a booming state economy that presumably enhances the well-being of the state's people. In fact, the state is still struggling with poverty despite a strong national economic recovery. The KFF report notes that 33.5% of North Carolina residents had incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level in 2018, which was larger than the U.S. share, 30.4%. And with more poverty comes more health problems. Indeed, in terms of its national health ranking, North Carolina has slipped from 31st in 2015 to 36th in 2019. In specific categories, the KFF report shows North Carolina exceeding the national average in adult obesity, heart disease, HIV diagnosis, infant mortality, the death rate due to firearms, and the opioid overdose death rate. These health problems and others are made worse by a lack of access to health care. Nearly 13% of non-elderly North Carolinians have no health insurance, compared to 10.4% nationally. That's a million people who must pay for health care on their own or go without. Many do the latter. The report found that 15.1% of its residents, ages 18 and older, did not see a doctor when needed during the previous year because of cost in 2018, higher than the U.S. percentage, 12.9%. North Carolina's uninsured numbers would be worse had it not been for the Affordable Care Act, a law that the state's legislative leaders resisted at every turn. Nonetheless, 447,680 North Carolinians were enrolled in ACA plans in 2019, with 94% of them receiving a tax credit to help them pay their premiums. If North Carolina had expanded Medicaid in 2018, the report estimates that 357,000 uninsured adults would have been eligible for the state and federal health insurance program. To create a healthier North Carolina, expanding Medicaid is the biggest and perhaps the simplest step. But the state must also do more to reduce the causes of poverty and close the racial gaps in health conditions. That means increasing the minimum wage and the number of small businesses that offer health insurance benefits. Among North Carolina private businesses with fewer than 50 employees, only 19% offer health insurance, compared to 29% nationally, the KFF report said. The state should also offer or should require employers to offer paid leave to workers when new children are born or adopted, or when serious personal or family health issues arise. Currently, only 12% of North Carolina's workers have that benefit. Creating more parks for exercise and better access to healthy foods would also help. Every 10 years, the state announces its health goals for the decade ahead. This year, the state's Healthy North Carolina 2030 report called for action beyond wider access to health care. The report says long-term sustainable improvements in the health and well-being of North Carolinians will only occur by addressing the social, economic, and place-based challenges that keep people from achieving optimal health. Tax cuts and holding out on Medicaid expansion won't do that. Next, the economic impact of the outbreak. There are many ways to measure the cost of coronavirus. There have now been more than 24,000 officially reported cases, and nearly 500 people have died, but we would be wise not to have much faith in these figures. A report from The Lancet estimated that as of January 25th, the true number of coronavirus cases in Hubei province, which includes the city of Wuhan, was not 761, as officially reported, but 75,815. The impact on China's economy will be considerable. Quarantine and internal border controls have been imposed, and local officials are now overcompensating in response to criticism from Beijing that they were slow to respond to the initial outbreak. Businesses and schools are likely to remain closed for weeks. Economic activity in many Chinese cities is sharply reduced. There is also the mounting economic cost for the entire global economy. The outbreak of severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS, in 2003 knocked 1 to 2 percentage points off China's GDP that year, which then cost 0.25 to 0.33 percentage point in global growth, according to estimates. The larger number of infections from the coronavirus suggests the impact could be more severe this time for both China and the world. What happens in China matters more than ever for the rest of us. Its share of the global economy has surged from 8% in 2002 to 19% today, and it's now the world's second largest economy. Companies in other countries dependent on China's supply chains are already facing a slowdown. Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Italy, and the U.S. have all imposed travel restrictions. Asian countries will see a sharp reduction in the number of arriving Chinese tourists, an important source of growth. Oil prices have fallen 20% over the past month on expectations of lower demand from China and reduced sales of jet fuel as flights are grounded. Press reports suggest that China's daily crude oil consumption has fallen by 20%, an amount equal to consumption in Britain and Italy combined. OPEC and Russian officials are now debating whether to cut oil production to buoy prices. Prices for metals and other construction materials have fallen. This is also a hit to the Phase 1 trade deal the U.S. and China concluded last month. China was already unlikely to purchase the additional $200 billion of U.S. goods over 2 years that it committed to buying. The slowdown will make that figure hard to achieve. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.